This podcast features criminologists discussing sensitive themes and topics. Listener discretion is advised. Told she could probably work as a secretary, this woman went on to the top ranks of the FBI and even inspired a famous movie character. This is the Janna Monroe story. Hi, Amy, and hello to our audience.
Hey, Megan, is this our final case for Women's History Month?
Well, this is my second Women's History Month case or inspired episode. And yes, this is it for us, I think. But I'm sure it's not a huge surprise that I chose a woman who succeeded in law enforcement and paved the way for others.
Very cool.
I discovered Janna's story when I was looking for a book to read, and I came across her memoir. Now, that's usually your thing, but this time it was mine. Her memoir is Hearts of Darkness, which is where I drew most of my information for today's episode. Janna discusses her entrance into policing, the challenges she faced along the way as she climbed the ranks to the FBI, making it to the prestigious unit, the BSU, for those of you who don't know, Behavioral Sciences Unit, which is often considered the top of the FBI. And she was one of the first women through the door, so she can describe all the steps along the way, which I thought was very interesting. So I'll describe some of Janna's work and her other positions and how she maybe inspired a famous movie character.
Are you going to tell us what movie character? We have to wait till the end.
You have to wait till the part of my story when I get there,
okay,
but fine. You'll know who it is when I get there, I promise. For now, Amy, though, let's start with Janna's early life. Janna Monroe was born around 1954 in small town Nebraska, where her parents had met and married almost 20 years earlier. Her mother was a young bride. She was about 15 years junior to Janna's father, and Janna was their only child. Now, they moved when Janna was young, and she was raised in Southern California. Her childhood, she describes as a pleasant one. She said that her parents were not very social. They had a very, very small kind of world, small social circle, but they were very content with that. You know, she describes like her mom's big project of the year was redoing the kitchen for like, or repainting the kitchen on 4th of July, things like that. They went bowling, but that was about it. But they were very content. They didn't like to travel, but Janna said that she found her excitement through the local movie theater where her father worked as a projectionist. I just think that's the coolest thing in the world because can you imagine as a little kid going to the theater and your father's actually running the movies and you're sitting there behind the scenes?
That's really cool.
Even though her mother was a homemaker and was the parent most responsible for raising Janna at home, she just spent, as she says, a lot of time with her dad at the theater. So she feels like that's where she was raised. At the time, she particularly loved the Dirty Harry series starring Clint Eastwood. And so that's where she found some of her inspiration. And she loved films like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. So she was kind of inspired by policing and Law and Order films. And she says that she was just really a Law and Order kid. She always had respect for the rules, and she expected others to as well. So I guess it was no surprise that she kept becoming interested in issues of justice and law, and eventually she went on to major in criminology at Long Beach State University, where she graduated in 1976. Now, Janna got married when she was in college. She was only 21 years old at the time, and perhaps it was just a little too young or a mismatch because her husband wanted more of a traditional marriage and Janna didn't. He was, according to her, tolerant of her ambition at first. Her ambition was to work in law enforcement. And she said that it was okay because he was such a decent guy. He was a nice man. And the only problem was, I think, given their age, that he didn't really understand that her ambition was much more long term. And this wasn't just a, oh, I hope I can obtain this and move on to my traditional lifestyle at the time.
How did the two meet?
Her husband, she met at college and he was another student, I believe. Okay. And Jada was graduating at a very interesting time, Amy, since the Equal Employment Opportunity Act of 1972 had passed by the time she was job hunting. I teach about this in my Women in Crime class. So the act mandated equal work opportunities for racial minorities and females. And essentially, it was the legislation that opened the doors for females in law enforcement. So even though it was a law now, and that's what the law required, it didn't necessarily mean that men in the field were happy about this at the time. While Jana found inspiration in characters like Angie Dickinson's policewoman in the 1970s, I remember that, by the way, she also didn't see herself as an undercover agent working as a flight attendant or a dancer, which was kind of the roles that Angie Dickinson played in the show. But she did get her foot through the door in a field that I am very familiar with. And that's because her first significant position in the field was working in probation. Now, she took a job in juvenile probation. It's not where she wanted to wind up, but it's certainly not a bad starting point either for anyone in the field then or now. She dealt primarily with juveniles who committed crimes, then committed violations. And she describes how some kids, their parents were just ready to be done with them and turn them over to the state because they didn't know what else to do. Though it might not have seemed like the most action-packed job, Jana definitely had her share of running, and I mean literally, after fleeing juveniles in Chino, California. So this was good practice for the career in front of her. She didn't stay with probation for too long, though, before applying for and securing a policing job in Chino in the 1970s. So I think you could probably imagine what policing was like for a female then. And I will say that I had some of the same experiences in probation, but not to the degree I think that Jan is describing. What I mean by this is that she was kind of expected to serve a specific role for a female officer at the time. So she was mostly assigned cases where there were female victims or children involved because it was thought females would interact better, you know, with child victims and with females.
Does she talk about experiencing discrimination from her male counterparts?
Yes, she does. Although I think Jana has a very good view on it. And this is kind of the discrimination that she's talking about. She was assigned certain cases that males were not assigned per se, but I think she also kind of rolled with it and said, all right, I'm going to do these cases, but I'm also going to keep pushing my foot through the door. And she asserted herself in ways that got her other jobs and other positions. What she said was, you can't always be at the party. You have to invite yourself to the party. The male officers weren't all receptive, but she was also good with people. And so Jana found some friendly faces, men who were working in the drug unit, and they were primarily doing drug busts. And she said, look, if you need additional help, I'd really love to be invited. She kind of invited herself to the party, mm-hmm. but she asserted herself in a way that they were receptive to. And they took her up on her offer. And she was invited on a major drug bust. And during that arrest, she was also invited to cuff a suspect, which was kind of a big deal as well. And though she describes being surprised by it, like someone threw her the cuffs and she kind of fumbled with the handcuffs, she got them on, and it was definitely a show of acceptance by her male counterparts, if that makes sense. But, you know, Jana had a lot of mistakes and learning curves along the way. She tells a great story in her book. I love that she includes this about her first knock and announce. For people who don't know that, it's a knock before entering to execute a search warrant. They can be very, very dangerous. You know, you never know what's on the other side of the door and when you're surprising someone. So Jana, on her first one, opens the door to find two people yelling at her, and it seemed like things were escalating quickly. So she drew her gun just in case, because she felt the threat. The problem was that Jana had also been wearing large hoop earrings, which is a big no-no in field work. You don't wear jewelry, and especially not hoop earrings. And she also had a bag on her shoulder. So when she drew her weapon, the bag slid up her shoulder and the strap caught on one of her earrings, essentially hanging from her earring, the bag, and causing her ear to bleed.
Wait,
and
was this
it was
like
kind
a purse?
Of a disaster.
Was this like a pocketbook she was carrying? What do you mean a bag?
It was kind of a purse that she said just like adrenaline fueled, she jumped out and didn't leave the bag behind.
Because this wasn't like a sting operation.
Well, it was a knock and announce. And, yeah, you know, right, it was one of her first. So, yeah, not, I mean, I love that she includes that, though, because she's showing, yeah, she was a rookie, a novice. Mm-hmm. She didn't think about these things. Luckily, the situation was not as serious as she thought. It would calm down. No one was harmed, but it was a great learning lesson. There were a lot of other incidents along the way that helped her learn. Now, one that she includes that I was glad she also included was a different perspective. And that was an experience she had where a male officer explained that he did not want Jana along on a gang-related call. And I think at first, you know, she couldn't understand that or took that offensively. But as he explained it, he said, look, this is a very dangerous place. And unfortunately, all the men on this call that are with you will go into protective mode over you. And that will put us all kind of in danger. And I have to tell you, he's not wrong. So it happened once with me. I appreciated it. And I don't know that it was quite as serious, but one of my first visits in the field, it was an intense field operation. We were visiting with a non-compliant offender. I was with about 8 other men. And when we got out of the car, I got out of the van, there were people on the rooftops and they were throwing bottles at us, which is pretty dangerous and does happen, unfortunately, frequently. And the instinct of my male partners at the time was to kind of push me into the van and make sure that I was protected, which of course I appreciated, but I also see how that could put them in a more vulnerable position. So Jana did understand this and she really didn't want to gain experience at their expense. So she worked in other areas and she found other ways to climb the ladder. One of the ways was that she worked as a school resource officer. But after a few years, Jana told her boss she wasn't getting anywhere with the types of assignments she got. And so she told him that she was going to apply to the FBI. Well, her then boss said that they wouldn't take her, but added, quote, I bet you $15 you're not going to get in, but if you do get through the written examination part of it, I'll write you a letter of recommendation.
Now, is this because of her gender or he didn't think she was a strong yes. enough candidate?
Okay. Because of her gender. Well, I'll tell you what, Amy, Jana got her $15 and she got her letter. She was going to be an FBI agent. In her book, she actually shows the framed $15 that she hung on her wall, which I would have done as well. However, while it was wonderful for her to get this FBI position, it also would put an end to her marriage.
What did her husband do?
I don't remember what he did for a living, but it was very, it was a 9-to-5 position and he had the expectation.
It wasn't in the field.
No, he was not in law enforcement. And so he couldn't really understand or relate to it. It was definitely a different position. And he did expect, you know, a wife who's going to be at home, cooking meals, that kind of thing, have children.
He may have been intimidated by her success also.
It's definitely possible. He wasn't thrilled about the FBI was definitely a bridge too far for him. I think he thought she would stop with getting her foot in the door in law enforcement. Despite her divorce, Jana reported for her 4-month training at the FBI in July of 1985. Only one of 8 women in the class, the new trainees mostly had backgrounds in military and law enforcement, but there were also attorneys and others who worked in accounting and business. Mm-hmm. And we know now law enforcement, especially federal law enforcement, are very interested in those who have backgrounds in business, mm-hmm. numbers, accounting, forensic accounting is huge. So there was diversity in her field then. Jana says that she loved the physical, the academic, and the ethical training that came with the academy. And it was there that she met another trainee with whom she shared her very core values, a man by the name of Dale Monroe. The academy for Jana was a great experience. And after she graduated, she was posted in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where she spent a lot of time on the surrounding Native American reservations, dealing with serious crimes that she felt like no one else wanted to handle. Which makes sense. We recently covered a case with crimes on reservations and how they're so problematic because of the pass-off between multiple agencies and the fact that a lot of people don't want to get involved. And also, I think when we talked about jurisdiction on the reservation, it becomes much more complicated, as I did point out in the episode on Lissa Yellowbird. But essentially, the FBI has jurisdiction over major crimes on tribal lands recognized by the federal government. So that was Jana's purview. She did describe her work as hard as well, though, because she was, first of all, an outsider coming in. And second of all, she wasn't recognized by many of the men on the reservations. So they did not welcome the female presence in law enforcement.
So would they simply just not listen to her? Or they were like outwardly disrespectful?
She said they were not very cooperative. Okay. When at times when she was investigating and she needed to speak with them, they had no interest in talking with her or really cooperating with her. So which can be a serious hindrance to an investigation, of course. Nonetheless, Jana worked her cases to the best of her abilities. But her relationship with Dale had also gotten very serious. And a few years after meeting in the academy, the two got married. There was one issue, though. Dale was stationed in Tampa, Florida, because he had experience as a pilot, and that's where he was needed. And Jana was in New Mexico. But luckily for them, the FBI is very good about keeping married couples stationed together. And so Jana was relocated to Tampa, where she primarily worked on violent crime investigations. And I think that was her goal. Now, Jana was involved in a murder case involving serious drug manufacturing. And she was consulted at the time by the BSU, which we talked about earlier, the Behavioral Sciences Unit. She wasn't in the unit at the time, but she was working as a liaison in the Tampa office for that division. And I don't know if that was an assignment or if she volunteered for that because she had her sights set on the BSU. Whatever it was, her work impressed quite a few people in the BSU office. And so they encouraged her to interview when an opening became available. And Amy, she was interviewed by none other than John Douglas, the famous FBI profiler who worked on several serial murder cases. He interviewed Bundy, Ed Kemper, Berkowitz, and more.
When he interviewed Jana, was he at the height of his career or it was before he kind of became in the spotlight?
So I wouldn't say he was at the height of his career because he went on to conduct more of these interviews and became very well known to interview serials and also wrote books. Mm-hmm. But he was certainly not a novice either. Mm-hmm. He was very well known at the time. And again, like I said, he's published many books. He's inspired a lot of characters. There's a character that is said to have been developed after him on the show Criminal Minds, which all of my students watch still, by the way. I find that so surprising because it's kind of an older show. Mm-hmm. And Netflix's Mindhunter. So there's a character as well based on off of John Douglas. And Jana's interview in 1987 with him must have gone well because she was hired as a BSU trainee. Now, in her 8 months of training, Jana studied crimes, offenders, victims, and attended many autopsies before beginning her official duties. Once on the job, she was often presented with cases in which she had to determine linkage. So that was one of her specialties. Were the victims linked to one or more offenders? And how could we tell?
Megan, doesn't this sound like the dream job? Like going to school for forensic psychology, then criminal justice. This is the person I wanted to be. And I feel like a lot of students do as well.
I think most of our students come in aspiring to be someone like Jana. Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. And yeah, it would have been the dream for me as well. And Jana worked some very memorable cases, one of which I remember quite well, and it's one of her saddest cases. I don't think you'll know it. It's not a highly publicized case per se, but I just remember it. It was the murder of Joan Rogers and her daughters, 17-year-old Michelle and 14-year-old Christy. Now, Joan had taken her two daughters from Ohio to Disney World in 1989 after Michelle graduated.
I do know this case, Megan. I listened to a podcast on this case. It's fascinating.
Oh.
Yes.
Okay. I stand corrected and I apologize, Amy. Okay. So they were going to Disney after Michelle graduated high school. It was an adventure. They'd never really done a road trip together like this. They checked into a Days Inn. They ate dinner. They did a couple of things. I think checked in with her husband and their father. But shockingly, a few days later, their bodies, all three of these women, their bodies floated up in Tampa Bay. They were naked with their hands bound and ropes around their necks that were attached to cinder blocks to weigh down their bodies. It was awful and it was totally unexpected. Joan's husband, Hal, had no idea that they were even missing. Remember, this is before cell phones and constant contact. There might have been phone calls once in a while, but he was informed of their shocking murders. He had stayed home and he had just found out that his whole family was gone.
If I recall, Megan, didn't they find a clue written on like a napkin in the hotel room with like a name and number?
Yes, absolutely. Hold that thought because you are right. And Jana's contribution will come in on that note. But at first, eyewitnesses reported seeing a certain car, and two women came forward who reported being assaulted under similar circumstances. They were promising leads, but they didn't go very far. The one promising lead they had is the one you just mentioned, though, Amy, or asked about. And this was a handwritten note in Joan's car on how to get from her hotel to the area in which their car was found. And their car was found near a boat docking area. So early profiles noted the offender's experience with tying knots because of the ropes, attention to detail, possible social skills, in that he was able to get these victims to probably go on a boat. He was able to get them to go somewhere with him. But it wasn't those profiles, even though they were very valuable, or the eyewitnesses that solved the case. It was that note. It was thought to have been written by Joan. And that's what most people thought for a while. But it was Jana who suggested perhaps the note wasn't written by Joan. Perhaps it was written by the offender in this case. And her suggestion was, why doesn't the FBI publish this note? Let's blow it up, let's publish it, and let's put it on a billboard. Kind of like an eyewitness identification for someone who might recognize the handwriting, which we've seen done in a few other cases.
I would imagine Joan's husband said that it wasn't her handwriting either.
I'm not sure if they had shared the note with him immediately. I don't know what the sharing of information was at the time. So I don't know that that happened. Okay. I will tell you, after they posted this on the billboard, just 48 hours later, they had identified suspect named Oba Chandler by his handwriting. Chandler was a 46-year-old man working as an aluminum siding contractor who was later linked to other murders before he was executed for these crimes. Jana said the most important thing she learned at BSU and from these cases is that God was in the details. She used the case of Jeffrey McDonald to illustrate this point in her memoir, pointing to the details of the crime scene. So where he claimed that intruders had killed his wife and children after a violent struggle with him. Jana looked around and so did others, and they wanted to know why, if there was a violent struggle, where there were, I guess, maybe Valentine's Day cards or Easter cards. There were some type of cards that were still standing on a table, untouched, standing up. They hadn't been knocked over. Why were the plates balanced perfectly where a struggle took place, but the plates hadn't moved?
Yep.
There was a heavy coffee table at the scene, standing perfectly on its side. As Jana said, it looked like a staged scene. So Jana's cases revolved around these details.
You know, Megan, that case has been on my list forever. I find that case very fascinating. And I'm a person that
We've talked about it too.
Yeah, we did. And I remember someone wrote saying, like, how could you possibly think there's a shred of doubt in this case? Do you remember we got some hate review on that case?
I do. Yeah, I do. So if you're going to cover it, we can address this all over again. But I thought it was a good point in illustrating the details, the small details that you might overlook.
Yep.
Now, Jana consulted on cases with serial offenders like Ted Bundy, Dahmer, and Ed Kemper, but she didn't interview those offenders specifically. Though, she once had a phone call from Ed Kemper, who wanted to offer his help. Ed Kemper is a highly intelligent offender. He's also very kind of flat, monotone, and chilling, but he had confessed to his crimes, and he was one of few offenders who called law enforcement and asked to be arrested.
Meg, can you remind me, how many victims did Ed Kemper end up having?
I believe it was seven. Let me go through his background a little bit. It was probably more than that because Kemper murdered his grandparents by shooting them when he was a teenager. And he served a sentence in a juvenile detention center. But when he was released after a couple years, he was released to his mother's custody, with whom he had an extremely tumultuous relationship. And it was advised by counselors that he never be reunited with his mother to live. Against court recommendations, he was released to his mother's care. Kemper later went on to murder his mother, defiling her head sexually. He also lured and sexually assaulted and murdered his mother's best friend, as well as five female college students and one high school girl. So I'm really not great at math, but in the end, I think it was 7 or 8 victims at that one time, plus his grandparents. Mm-hmm. So Kemper was certainly, as the BSU would have noted, a serial killer. Now, Kemper had always prided himself on having good relationships with law enforcement, and he was always extremely cooperative and enjoyed the conversation. Kemper also believed, as some serial offenders do, that his information could aid law enforcement on similar crimes. And so he offered insights into a case Jana was working on, and she listened.
In exchange for what?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Kemper was one of those who liked to talk. He didn't ask for anything. As I said, he liked being a friend of law enforcement. Mm-hmm. He considered himself that way, and he was highly intelligent. Remember, also, boredom. Mm-hmm. When it was asked of Jana why she thought Kemper was so eager to help, she said it was ego, and there is ego involved. Mm-hmm. She also said that she won't ever forget the conversation with him because of that monotone voice. She said it was chilling. Mm. And to this day, it reminded her of another serial killer, one who is probably very well known to a lot of our listeners. That is Hannibal Lecter.
Oh, I know now. It's Jodie Foster now. It just hit me that that's who portrays her in the movie.
Well, I hope you didn't just ruin it for the rest of us.
Okay.
Okay. So the 1988 book Silence of the Lambs by Thomas Harris made the fictional character Hannibal Lecter one of the most terrifying serial killers of all time. Mm-hmm. And not long after the book came the movie, where Lecter was famously played and brilliantly played by Anthony Hopkins. I would like to point out that I've read the book and seen this movie way too many times. It's probably all wrong. The character of Lecter, though fictional, was loosely inspired by a real Mexican doctor who murdered and mutilated his victims. So there was some real-life inspiration here. While the film was underway, the FBI headquarters provided the film crew with access to shoot certain scenes. They wanted to shoot at the actual academy. And during the filming, Jana was assigned to be Starlet, Jodie Foster's handler. So Jana met with Jodie regularly to walk her through what it was like to be one of the first females on the job. If you recall from Silence of the Lambs, for those who have watched it, that's probably most people, that was a huge part of the story, was Jodie's entrance into the field and the way she was treated by other male officers in most of her situations. So that came from Jana, the treatment that she received, how Jana made an impression, how she interviewed serial offenders, and the physical work. So really all aspects of being one of the first females through the door. That's what Jana imparted. Jana tells a great story where Jodie's body double was going to do the obstacle course for the movie, but Jana was encouraging Jodie. She's like, "You're younger than I am. You're fit. You can do it." And so that's just what Jodie Foster did. She completed that rigorous course on her own. One of Jana's stories to Jodie would wind up in the movie. In fact, one of the most famous scenes, though not for good reason. I know you watched the movie, but do you remember it real well?
I've seen it once, and it was years and years ago. I know the story, of course, but I don't remember the movie really at all.
Yeah, it's not your kind of movie. You don't watch these kinds of movies. I, however, would study this movie, but okay. Well, there was a famous scene where Jodie Foster, whose character was Clarice Starling, Agent Starling, was entering the prison to meet Hannibal Lecter for the first time. It was a very scary scene. She was walking through the halls with, offenders who were considered the worst or the most dangerous. And there was a lot of tension. And in that hallway, she encountered an inmate who threw his own ejaculate at her. I don't know if you remember that, but that felt as real to Jana watching it as it did when it happened. So she had shared that experience with Jodie and the team, and they incorporated that into the movie.
So that scene was based on real events that happened to Jana?
Correct.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and it was kind of terrifying in the movie and unexpected. So you can imagine what it felt like in real life. And again, Jana said watching it was like feeling it happened to her. In the end, Silence of the Lambs was a hit and interestingly became the FBI's best recruiting tool for women at the time. It wasn't the only time a famous woman had come to learn from Jana, but unfortunately, her second brush with a star would not be as rewarding. Demi Moore had come to the FBI to learn how to play the part of a medical examiner in a Patricia Cornwell novel that was being turned into a movie. Despite the fact, as Jana pointed out, that the BSU didn't have a medical examiner in place full time, so it wasn't quite realistic. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, she said that Demi came in seemingly unenthused. While in consultation about a triple homicide, Demi simply walked out of the room after a few minutes. She just wasn't, I guess, that interested in sitting around for a couple hours of a strategy session. And Jana felt that she got downright nasty when Jana took a photo of her on the firing range, threatening to sue her. So
this sounds so gossipy.
What's that?
This sounds very gossipy for like this kind of book. I'm assuming it read different.
It
though. Oh, okay.
You know, it definitely, yeah, it did read a little bit differently. Yeah. I guess you're right. Yeah. But I think she was trying to also impart how, you know, Jodie Foster, I think it was just showing the difference about how she, one woman came in like so enthused mm-hmm. to learn and whatnot. And the other one, unfortunately, just in her opinion, wasn't mm-hmm. that interested. Mm-hmm. As Jana said, in the end, Miss Congeniality, Demi was not. So yeah, perhaps a little gossipy, mm-hmm. but it was fun gossip. In the end, it was a short stay in a film that never got made. But of course, I think that moments like these as well were kind of memorable at the BSU and kind of exciting for them to have, you know, movie stars and films being shot on their premises. Okay, so let me turn to Jana's memoir, Hearts of Darkness. She refers to those people who may have seemed normal at one time, but went on to commit unspeakable acts. And the question of why they do it is at the heart of Jana's job at BSU and others. During her career, Amy, Jana consulted on 850 homicide cases, most of them the most extreme. And while there's a ton of terrible homicides, the ones we know the best are obviously the ones that got a lot of press coverage. One particular famous case that Jana consulted on was the Timothy McVeigh case, the Oklahoma City bomber, who killed 168 people in 1995 and who was subsequently executed by lethal injection for his actions. Now, Jana was tasked with assessing McVeigh's actions by getting to know him through correspondence between McVeigh and his little sister, who he clearly adored. McVeigh bragged about his accomplishments, many of them, but Jana was able to determine that they weren't real and that this was likely an act of revenge on those who had discounted him, particularly ones who didn't think that this ex-soldier was qualified for the special forces. That was one of his goals as a soldier. He just didn't make it through the ranks. He was disqualified from achieving that goal.
So Jana didn't have a background in psychology, right? Because it sounds like a lot of her job is profiling with a little bit of psychology in there, right?
Interestingly, well, her background was in criminology, which did, as we know, it does encompass some psychology as well. But I think then, too, the training was on the job.
Gotcha. Because I think today to do a job like that, you would have to have probably a PhD in forensic or clinical psychology.
That's a good question. I'm not sure if you need a PhD, but I assume yes.
Maybe at the time, maybe a master's at least.
Yeah, I would think so mm-hmm. as well. Jana was also heavily involved with a surge of crimes in which women killed other pregnant women for their babies, which she said at the time there was a surge for. She didn't explain the reasons why.
Sure. We covered quite a few of cases like that.
Yes, we have covered a few. And Jana was involved in interviewing some of these women who found themselves lying to a boyfriend or a spouse about a pregnancy and then scrambling at the 7th month mark to figure out what to do. In telling of their crimes later on, Jana noted that their descriptions of the murders always had a way of disconnecting. The offenders always disconnected themselves from the act of killing, which was one of the noticeable patterns in their descriptions. So as she described it, when they were talking about their crimes, instead of saying, you know, that they used a knife, they would say things like, the knife just moved, or the knife went in, or this just happened. So she noted that as one of the common themes in her profiling of these types of offenders. One of the most prolific cases that Jana consulted on was that of Eileen Wuornos, who I cover extensively in my classes. known as the first female serial killer, which is far from true, by the way. Eileen was convicted of murdering 7 men in Florida in the late 1980s in the course of her encounters with these men as a sex worker. Eileen shot the men and stole their money, cars, and other valuables after their murders, and she was demonized in the media. The media rarely ever discuss the unbelievable abuse, abandonment, and trauma Eileen suffered at a very young age. That was covered later in documentaries, but the media pretty much ignored those factors.
She has one of the more horrific backgrounds that I've seen.
Absolutely. But Jana said that Eileen was easier to profile because she was more straightforward than most other serial killers and more honest. Jana said, look, Eileen said she hated men. They had victimized her entire life. She did not mind killing them to get what she needed. Eileen said that she still felt hatred. If she was released, she would probably commit the crimes again. And so in that regard, Jana said she was just much more straightforward and easier in terms of profiling.
I wonder if it's because she was a woman, you know, talking to a woman, maybe she felt more comfortable.
No, she's not talking about directly what she said. She's just talking about what Eileen said publicly, what was contained in reports. Eileen, yeah, I found her very straightforward as well. More straightforward than a lot of the male counterparts. This also might be because female serial killers tend to be more utilitarian than males, which does make their motives more straightforward. Jana said that Eileen had hate running through her system, and Eileen had said it. If she was ever released, she would kill again. She was straightforward. I think that it made her easier to profile than most of her male counterparts. And in fact, you know, female serial killers tend to be more utilitarian than male serial killers. So it does make them a little bit more straightforward. But Eileen was never deceptive in that regard. Now, Jana spent a lot of her time profiling victims as well, noting the method of murder, how victims were found, other characteristics that possibly established linkage. Her incredible abilities to find these links and her attention to detail came with a terrible price, though. If you think about it. So we talk about the plus side of what we would want to do and work in this field. Well, her work often involved hanging gruesome photos of victims in her office, in her home. She lived with them. She lived with the constant details, and it became normalized. She said that living with these murders also affected the way she lived her life. So her habits at home, she said she would hide the knives in her home, sometimes in the washer or dryer, so that no intruder could kill her with her own knives. I mean, she literally describes a time where Dale was trying to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and was like, where are the knives in the house? There were other things that she described, like if she would stay at a hotel, she would go up a couple floors, down a couple floors, just to make sure no one was tracking her. And so I think that after 5 years, Jana began to envision life beyond the BSU. And, you know, she was interested in moving back into more mainstream investigations. Also because in the BSU, there wasn't much room for advancement. And Jana wanted to advance. She felt that she could do more in the field. And so after 5 years with the BSU, Jana took a new posting in sunny San Diego. Now, Jana was excited to return to investigations and pursue these leadership opportunities. But San Diego is quite different because it was not high in violent crime, and Jana had found herself in the middle of serious violent crimes for quite a long time. In this regard, Jana found herself working on white-collar crimes, which are not usually the coveted ones for those pursuing excitement or action, which Jana was kind of oriented towards. But as I discuss in my classes, white-collar crimes can be far more damaging than violent crimes, as they tend to affect much larger groups of people. You taught a class, Amy, didn't you, on white-collar crimes?
Yeah, I found it kind of interesting. I was not excited to teach it because I don't particularly find white-collar crime interesting, but it actually was better than I thought it would be. Because I also think you don't realize how many crimes fall under white-collar crime, and it's interesting to think about the theories right. And how they apply to white-collar versus street crime. Did she like it? It sounds like she wouldn't like something like that.
She didn't at first, I don't think, but she did come to like it. She found herself, I'll tell you about the frustration. She found herself working on some cases, one in particular she describes involving judicial corruption. And she was very pleased that her investigation had led to the apprehension of several dirty judges, which she upset her very much, especially being a law and order type, to see those in the positions of law enforcement taking bribes and doing other things was very disappointing for her. And she was very proud of their convictions, but very disappointed later at sentencing. Do you know why?
Because they got lenient sentences.
Yeah, I found I shared the same sentiment as Jana when I worked on white collar cases and probation. Mm-hmm. They got short sentences for crimes that were egregious. Mm-hmm. And they're often perceived as less harmful. And this is always shocking to me. It's the construction by media, politicians, and others of violent crime as being inherently more destructive. But mm-hmm. I would say, you know, there are large white-collar frauds that wind up with people losing their life savings, becoming severely depressed or sick. They can't afford health care. So some of them die as a result. Yeah. Many people have taken their lives as a result of these losing their entire savings. And so when they say these crimes are not as serious, I say crimes that will life alter the masses are much more serious, maybe.
Yeah, I think the harm's not as tangible. That's why it's harder to track.
Exactly.
Because like you said, the effects are often mental health, physical, and there's a domino effect. It affects so many people. It's really hard to know what's causing what.
That's exactly well put. So after putting in her time in white collar for about 4 years, Jana was awarded another promotion to special agent in charge of the Denver office.
I'm so jealous. Not she's going to San Diego, then Denver. Sign me up.
I know. In her position, she found herself quickly involved in a high-profile case as well, called the Texas Seven. This was a case in which seven serious prisoners escaped from a maximum security prison in South Texas by a very coordinated and planned attack on the officers. Oh. They planned distractions that facilitated their escapes in a prison vehicle after eluding camera detection. Oh. This is quite the plot. And by seven people, I've almost never heard of an escape to that magnitude.
No, sometimes you'll hear two people who work together, but I haven't heard.
Yep.
I don't think I've ever heard of more than two.
And especially because this plot worked. Mm-hmm. Now, as the lead came in, the prisoners had made their way to Colorado, which is why Jana found herself calling the shots on a major operation that involved recovering these inmates without harm to the public. Now, one of the inmates, the escapees, took his own life, and four men were quickly apprehended. But there were two others that eluded escape for another day, making their way to a hotel room in Colorado Springs, where they took two employees as hostages. Now, that had been the ultimate fear for the Bureau, that innocent people might be harmed or involved or killed. But through careful negotiations with these two men, with Jana at the helm, both the hostages and the remaining two of the Texas Seven were recovered safely. So this was a major success, and Jana received accolades for her leadership in this situation. And her star was still rising. As 9/11 came, she provided link assessments between the four aerial attackers. Her work was really quite extraordinary, and she was eventually promoted to special agent in charge of the LA office.
Now,
LA? Which was a prime location for field work. Yep. In the Bureau.
Very cool. How old is she at this point? I mean,
I'll get there. Okay. I'm almost there. Yeah. To how old she is. That's a good question. Much to her surprise, though, even though this was a very high appointment, Jana was put in charge of the newly established cyber division. And at the time, Jana says, I didn't know a thing. I didn't know cyber was spelt with a C or an S, you know? Showcasing her less than a extant knowledge of cyber crimes. But she took on the new program, setting up the offices, hiring the right consultants, getting everyone up to speed. By the time she appeared in front of the Senate Commerce Committee, the team was more than operational. They were logging 90,000 complaints a month and working those cases with technology, partnerships, and leadership, all that Jana built. So she had done her work there. And after that, she took her last position at the FBI in Phoenix, Arizona, her last foray into field work.
Another wonderful location.
I know. She actually got blessed with some great locations here, right?
Mm-hmm.
At this point, Jana was 51 years old and mandatory retirement was on the horizon in 5 or 6 years.
She's so young, though, to do all of that. Unbelievable.
It's incredible. Mm-hmm. But Jana was beginning to think about her next steps. And as fate would have it, Jana was offered a position with KPMG, one of the big four accounting agencies, in 2006, and she said it was a generous compensation package.
I'm sure.
So she decided to take it. It was time. Though her time with KPMG was short, as it wasn't the right fit for her, it paved the way for Jana to find her next career working in the private sector, where she still works today. Jana retired out of her field at age 51, her legacy in the world of the FBI being quite extraordinary and vast. She spent 25 years in law enforcement, opening the doors for women in many ways. She worked on these prolific cases, even ones if they were not found in the media. She rose to the top of her profession. And I would say a career well spent and certainly an inspiration to all of us during Women's History Month.
Yes. I like this case because it's nice to sometimes change it up a bit, right? Like we can smile and we can be happy about something. You know, of course, we talked about crimes a little bit. We talked about crimes throughout, but overall, I think it's, you know, a story, an inspirational story. It's a feel-good story. So thank you.
I think so, too. Thank you. And before we go today, Amy, I just want to give you and the audience, I know you're aware, but a sense of how women are represented in the field today. Yep. So what Jana did. We know that the first female police officer was hired in 1910, but those duties were not really in the capacity of an officer until I mentioned the Equal Opportunity Employment Act of 1972. Since then, women have become an integral part of the profession, but in smaller numbers than men. So today, 13% of officers are women, but this is still a male-dominated field. Even though there are certain physical barriers and others that I think keep women out to this day, even though women, studies have shown that women are much better in community policing situations, they're able to defuse situations, they are very strong with problem-oriented and, again, community situations, but they do still face discrimination in the field. There's also the fact that pregnancy becomes an issue, can be dangerous, so they have to either take leave or other jobs. So I would say not without its challenges, the field has become more accepting of women in general. And I read of one initiative called the 30-30, in which several law enforcement agencies have gotten together in an effort to promote a movement to 30% of officers being female by the year 2030. Oh, so I'll check back with you, Amy, in 6 years.
So I was going to say, where's the second 30 come from? But I got you. 30-30. Yes.
Got it. Okay. Uh-huh. When we turn to the FBI, as we discussed today, the number of women is higher. So in fact, 24% of agents are females and 60% are intelligence analysts. So I think the numbers should encourage us. Mm-hmm. I will say that there's another area of criminal justice in which the numbers are even higher, and that's corrections. So in correction officer positions, 25% to 50% of officers are females. Now, that depends on institutions as well. So 25% tends to be traditional adult facilities, where that number jumps to 50 in juvenile institutions. But certainly, it's more representative in that field. Finally, when we turn to women and the law, this is probably the area of the criminal justice system that has the most parity. I don't know if you're aware of this. I think I knew this, but I knew this from teaching it, but half of all law students are now women. Mm-hmm. When it comes to working in law firms and partnerships, there is a pressure on women because of the hours. So oftentimes, unfairly, women have to choose between making partnership or having families. So it does make sense that the active number of attorneys drops down to about 25 to 30%. However, that number is growing, and it's definitely encouraging. And there are more women on the judiciary than ever before as well. I mean, just look at our Supreme Court, how many females are on it, right? Okay, I could go on all day about this. And I just want to end by saying we definitely have ways to go in terms of females, but we're on a solid path forward. And I think we have great reason to celebrate this Women's History Month.
Yes. And a lot of our listeners and now viewers are people who are either working in the field, studying in the field, or doing something. So it's cool to see that there's, you know, we like our male listeners as well. And we know there are a lot of men also in these positions. But since today we're talking about a woman, I'll focus on the fact that we have a lot of listeners who are women who are very interested in this area.
Yeah, for today, we're celebrating the females. All right, everyone. Amy, I'm glad you enjoyed this case. I enjoyed writing it so much, as you could tell, my enthusiasm brimming over. We appreciate everyone who joined us today, and we'll catch you next time on Women in Crime.
Women in Crime is written and hosted by Megan Sachs and Amy Schlossberg. Our producer is James Varga. Script editing is by Abigail Bel Castro. Audio editing is by Siler Burr and Jose Alfonso. And music is by Desert Media. If you enjoy the show, please remember to follow and leave a review. You can also support the show through Patreon, where you can get access to additional ad-free content such as exclusive full-length episodes, lectures, a book club, and virtual happy hours with Megan and Amy. For more information, visit patreon.com/womenandcrime.
Sources for today's episode include A&E, Hearts of Darkness by Jana Monroe, The New York Post, FBI.gov, and Women, Gender, and Crime by Stacey Malicote.